Good morning. It is a pleasure to be here again and excited to share with you some interesting things. As we get started this morning, you'll see a picture on the screen that I'm sure that you're familiar with. In fact, here's another view. And this is obviously a monument known as Stonehenge, located in England. If you talk to people about Stonehenge and you ask them why was it built, they will tell you that it was built for religious purposes, or maybe it was built for some type of scientific observation because the stones are aligned a certain way with the rising of the sun and at solstice and things like that. But more recent studies also lead credence to the idea that Stonehenge was originally designed as a cemetery, because scans of the earth in the area show that there are over 240 people buried at Stonehenge. Whatever the reason for its construction, there's no doubt that people are amazed at its construction. What you have here are some large Sarsen stones weighing about 25 tons each, the largest being about 50 tons. In addition to those, you have 82 what are called blue stones, which are about 4 tons each. And those have been transported from 250 miles away. That would be the equivalent of taking an 8,000-pound rock from here and taking it to Bridgeport, Connecticut, all long time ago. We look at this and say, wow, that's amazing that they could do that. If we travel down to Peru, a very famous tourist site is a place known as Machu Picchu. Machu Picchu has over 100 different structures, which include things like thatched roofs. Well, the thatches aren't there anymore, but thatched roof huts. You've got stairways, some of which are built out of a single or carved out of a single block of granite, over 100 stairways. There are parks and sculptures and, most interesting, water features, fountains and channels that actually take water from springs to the buildings in turn. In other words, indoor running water. This was part of the Inca Empire, located high in the Andes Mountains. And we look at that and we say, that's amazing. Also not far from there is what is known as Sacsayhuaman, also located in the Andes Mountains, 12,000 feet in elevation. And this is part of the Inca Empire as well. It was actually the capital of the Inca Empire. What's most stunning is this fortress, this wall, which is made out of these very uniquely carved stones. These stones are absolutely huge, and some of these, the largest one, actually weighs up to 200 tons. Think about that, 400,000 pounds. Of course, people will often ask me, can we move a stone like that today? Well, easily. We've got cranes that can lift far more than that weight today. The problem would be getting the crane to Sacsayhuaman at 12,000 feet in elevation. And yet somehow the ancient Incas were able to do that. What's also interesting is these rocks that were quarried some distance away and transported to this location were all cut very precisely. You cannot put a knife blade or a piece of paper between these rocks. And no mortar was used to hold this wall together. Just the precision cutting of the rocks themselves. Whether we could do that today or not is questionable. We look at that and say, that's absolutely amazing. Of course, there's other large rocks that have been moved in the past. Maybe the largest one, or one that was planned to be moved, is the Aswan Obelisk, which is in Egypt. Had it been finished, it would have stood an amazing 137 feet high, the largest obelisk in ancient Egypt. It's about 3,000 years ago that sculptors were trying to dig this out of the quarry. And it appears that they abandoned their project because there was a crack that was discovered in the block, and it would have not been able to have been erected successfully without danger of cracking. And yet when we consider that this weighs almost 1,200 tons, that's an amazing thing. I mean, do the math on that. That's about 2.4 million pounds. Obviously, they had planned on moving it. Now, there's other obelisks not nearly that large that have been moved and put into place, some of them weighing over 1 million pounds. We're not sure how they did that. And people look at this and say, well, that's amazing. In the Mayan culture, if you go back again to South America, the Mayan Observatory, it's an interesting structure in and of itself, but what's even more interesting is the mathematics that the Mayans used. they were actually able to calculate that a solar year was 365.2420 days. Of course, those silly minds. Everybody knows that a solar year is actually 365.2422 days. They were off by 17.28 seconds. That's assuming that the revolution of the Earth has not slowed down slightly in the last 1,000 years. And so we look at this, we say, how could they have done that? That's amazing. The Antikythera mechanism, discovered by divers off the coast of Crete in the Mediterranean. It was discovered and thought to be some type of piece of navigational equipment discovered in 1901. They date this at approximately 87 BC. But it's now believed not to have been a piece of navigational equipment, but an analog computer designed to measure and predict the movement of stars and planets. If we take x-rays within the actual Antikythera mechanism, we find over 30 gears interconnected, a type of technology that was not supposed to have been developed until the 16th century in Europe. And yet this was 100 years before Christ that this computer existed. And we look at that, and we're just amazed at that. Just outside of Baghdad in Iraq, there's a village, a 2,000-year-old village, where they were doing some excavating. They came up with a 6-inch clay pot, yellow clay. Inside was a copper cylinder. It had been soldered with a tin-lead alloy, and inside that cylinder was an iron rod that was corroded. And you can see the iron rod there. They built some reconstructions of these devices, trying to figure out what was this thing. Eventually, a German archaeologist thought he figured out what it might have been. And so he took a reproduction, he poured a weak acid into it, he actually used wine, and he was able to actually produce an electric current. What we believe these are 2,000-year-old wet cell batteries. That's amazing. This would help us to understand, of course, things like what appear to be electroplated artifacts, both in the Middle East, in that area, also in Egypt. Now, we've not found any batteries in Egypt, but there is jewelry on display in Egyptian museums that appears to have been electroplated. Think about what this means. This means that somewhere 200 years before or 200 years after Christ, people were using basic forms of electricity. Move over Ben Franklin. This is an amazing thing. And it's amazing to us because subconsciously or consciously, we have bought into the idea of the evolution of man. I believe even subconsciously, most Christians have bought into the idea that we are getting better. And so when we hear about ancient man doing these types of things and this type of technology existing thousands of years ago, we're stunned. We're surprised by it. Because we've bought into this idea that we're getting better. And so we can't understand how ancient man could have done such amazing things. And so that has led even to some very fanciful explanations. Again, back in Peru, there's an area where the ground is very light-colored but covered with dark-colored stones. If you push those dark stones out of the area, it reveals the light earth underneath, and you can actually make a pattern. This is what the Nazca Indians did long ago, back in, again, about 1,000 or 2,000 years ago, and made some of these immense geometric patterns and illustrations on this desert floor. But they're only visible, as far as what they are, from aircraft. And because of that, some people have said there's no way these ancient peoples would have been able to do something like this unless they had help from aliens. And so it was back in the 1970s, I believe, that Richard von Daniken released his book, Chariots of the Gods. And in that book, he proclaims that the reason we have the Egyptian pyramids and the Nazca lines and all of these amazing technologies from the ancient past is because aliens from another planet came and helped us out. His main point, mankind would not have been able to do it on their own. We were too primitive. You see, we have bought into this idea that man is evolving and therefore getting better. And yet this is in direct contrast to the scripture reading this morning and what the Bible tells us, that God has created us in his own image, both male and female. Now, I teach middle school and high school biology, anatomy and physiology, and life science. I also teach a Bible class. And when I talk about being created in the image of God, I always go over and pick up a small mirror that I have. And I'll walk up to a student with that little mirror, and I'll hold it up to the student and say, just imagine there's a mirror here. Is this what God looks like? And the rest of the students laugh. And, of course, that's not what God looks like. Because when we talk about being created in the image of God, this is not what the Bible is talking about. It's not our physical being. Scripture says that God is a spirit. And so when we are created in the image of God, it's referring to our spirit. The part of us that is in the image of God is the ability to think, to reason, to have relationship with each other. It's the part of who we are that allows us to be creative. That's all part of the image of God. And because we were created in perfection in the image of God, we were highly intelligent. But following man's sin in the garden, we have started this process of decay and degeneration. And yet thousands of years ago, there would have been individuals who were still highly intelligent. And so these ancient technologies really should not come as a surprise to us. And yet we live in a world today that seems very bent on trying to convince us otherwise. That we were not created special, but we were simply the products of random processes over time, and that we evolved into existence from some ape-like ancestor. You've all heard the story. If you go to Washington, D.C., the Smithsonian has, I think it's only about 3-4 years old now, their new Hall of Human Origins, a $25 million display that's there for one purpose only, to convince you that you evolved from an ape-like ancestor. And as you walk through this display, there's a lot of different skulls and a lot of different things there to try to show evidence for this. What breaks my heart when I visit is how many of the displays seem designed for children.
Have a seat, dearie, and let mommy take a picture of you getting a piece of meat from the ape man.
That's pretty much what the mom said when she invited her daughter to sit down at this sculpture so she could take a picture. And while she took a picture, I quick snapped one as well. All right, because this is the idea. And I heard as people were walking around, parents saying to their children, this is what we used to look like. This is what our ancestors look like. This was your great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather. And the children are absorbing this and picking this up. And if you've not studied these things and you walk through that display, it is unsettling because it appears that there is so much information. It appears there's so much scientific evidence. But is there really? What we need to do is take a look at some of this evidence that's often presented. And I want to talk about how the evidence is presented. Take a look at this photograph. This is a photo of a painting from a magazine that was dealing with the evolution of man. And I invite you to look at that painting and to see what you would notice there. When you ask people, they'll say things like, well, you'll see he has kind of a contemplative gaze. There's almost an intelligence in the face. Standing erect, hands that are very human-like, holding tools. You know, is this what this creature actually looked like upon which the fossil was based? They actually interviewed the artist of this painting, and this is what the artist said. He said, I wanted to get a human soul into this ape-like face, indicating something about where he was headed. In other words, there was a reason for painting it this way, was to create a perception of humanness. And so the way things are presented, often we have to understand, are slanted. I try to teach my students very clearly to separate facts from interpretation. And all facts must be interpreted. Creationists and evolutionists don't disagree on the facts. We disagree on the interpretation of the facts. If you go back to Washington, to the Smithsonian, they've got this little dude here. And he stands only about this tall. And he's gazing up at you with this very intelligent look on his face. You almost feel like you could have a conversation with this individual. That's the interpretation, but what you have to understand is the fact is this is the skull upon which that model is based. What's interesting, if you were to travel around the country and go to different museums and look at different museums' interpretations of that exact same skull, you would see that the interpretations differ greatly. You see, the skull is a fact. All of these other things are simply interpretations. And yet people will look at something like this in a display and they say, oh, that's what this creature looked like. Well, not necessarily.
One of the most famous of all of the fossil finds that you probably have heard of is known as Lucy. This slide is entitled Lucy and the Australopithecines. I know that sounds like a bad rock group, but Lucy, also known as Australopithecus afarensis, this is a reproduction of what some scientists believe Lucy looked like. I said some because not all of these bones have been found, and so certain bones have been found. The rest has been kind of filled in, added teeth added, and things like that. Originally discovered in 1974 by Donald Johansson and his team, about 40% of the fossil was discovered. You can see there on the cover of the book the picture of the skeleton. When it was discovered, the news media went nuts, and you heard things like, almost complete skeleton found. Now, I look at that as a school teacher, and I think, if a student were to hand an assignment to me and say, hey, it's almost complete, and it's only 40% finished, you can imagine what kind of grade they would get. And I wouldn't say, hey, it's almost complete. They barely got started. But nonetheless, this was a big deal. It was claimed to be 3.5 million years old and claimed to be bipedal, or in other words, walked on its two legs. This is, again, a view of the skeleton itself, and this is how it has been reproduced, in this particular case, at the St. Louis Zoo. It's not just museums that have evolutionary-based displays. Many times zoos get in on the act as well. And the St. Louis Zoo has this display saying, this is what Australopithecus afarensis actually looked like. But what I want you to take notice specifically of is look at the feet. And then look at the skeleton over here. And look at the foot bones. Well, we're not seeing much there. Or the hand bones, we're not seeing much there. Because the original find didn't really have anything. We have found some later. But this model was originally based on the original skeleton. Well, how is it that textbooks and museums, and they show these beautiful feet, very human-like feet? Well, to get our answer, we actually have to travel almost 1,000 miles away from Ethiopia to another country, Tanzania, to a place known as Lutoli, where they have found some footprints that have fossilized in what was once volcanic ash. These footprints are thought to be 3.5 million years old as well. And the big question is, who made the footprints? Now, I want to do a little science lesson here. I know it's been a while since some of you had biology. And so there are some differences between an ape foot and a human foot. And so I'll put this up there. It's a little test to see if you can figure out which one of these is actually an ape foot and which one is a human foot. If you're not sure, I'll give you a slight hint. Obviously, I'm being facetious. There's huge differences between an ape foot and a human foot, and you can clearly see that there. What's interesting is if we look at the Lutoli footprints, we see that they're similar to this. You see, when a human walks, we all walk the same way. We walk and we come down with our weight on the heel of our foot. As we rotate our foot forward, the weight transfers to the outside of our foot, crosses over the ball of the foot, and then most of the weight goes out through the big toe. And then your next heel comes down on your other foot. You can check that out. You'll see people walking out of the sanctuary like this as they're checking it out. And that is the way we walk. Apes, on the other hand, they walk with their weight on the outside of their feet. And so they have that kind of undulating gait that's like this. That and the fact that they have a different carrying angle of their femurs, their leg bones. When we look at the Lutoli footprints, what we find are these footprints are deepest at the heel, at the outside of the foot, across the ball of the foot, and out through the big toe. And so, in other words, they look very much like human footprints. In fact, Russell Tuttle has said, he's an anthropologist, he says that they are indistinguishable from those made by habitually barefoot Homo sapiens. In other words, they look exactly like human footprints. Donald Johansson himself, the one who discovered Lucy, talking about those footprints at Lutoli, says there's a well-shaped modern heel with a strong arch and a good ball of the foot in front of it. The big toe is in a straight line. It doesn't stick out the side like an ape toe. It looks like a human foot. And so I would look at that and say, hey, look, we have found human footprints. But that's not the accepted interpretation. And so the question is, who made these footprints? Australopithecus afarensis is the likely suspect because this is the only hominid whose remains have been found at Lutoli, and A. afarensis is the only known hominid to have lived in East Africa at the time the tracks were made, says Dr. Boyd. In other words, Australopithecus afarensis must have made the footprints And since we didn't have much to go on as far as foot bones are concerned, it was very convenient to say, ah, Lucy had nice feet, or very human-like feet. I wondered already, what would happen if we were to find a human bone in the Laetoli area? Well, they actually have now. We have found what appears to be the fourth metatarsal of a human foot bone. And instead of the evolutionists saying, oh, wow, I guess we were wrong, this is a human metatarsal, they picked it up and said, see, we told you Lucy had human-like feet. And so this is the idea that has been perpetrated. And yet, if you study the anatomy of the Australopithecines, and we've now discovered other Australopithecine skeletons as well, we find that that's not quite the case. In fact, Dr. Catchpool says a serious reconstruction error is to wrongly align Lucy's big toe alongside the smaller toes like a human foot. Looking at these new bones that have been found, anatomist Dr. Charles Oxnard has shown that the big toe actually sticks out as it does in chimpanzees. Anatomists Jack Stern and Randall Sussman, this is Milton stating this, describe Lucy's hands and feet as being long and curved, typical of a tree-dwelling ape. So in other words, the more recent discoveries of bones of the hands and feet make it appear that Lucy was more of a tree-dwelling ape type of creature. This is how it is displayed at the Creation Museum. And you can see it looks very different than what we saw at the St. Louis Zoo. In fact, the Creation Museum also has this display showing how it's possible to, again, take the skull of Lucy and you can make it into a lot of different things depending on what your preconceived ideas are. Interpretation versus fact. But still, we find museums and textbooks showing Lucy's feet to look very human-like. Yours probably look very much like that, although maybe not that hairy. Professor Betsy Schumann, evolutionary expert, admits that the statue's feet probably are not accurate. Now, with this new information, they talk to her. She says, yeah, the statue at St. Louis Zoo is probably not accurate. But when asked whether the statue should be changed, her answer, absolutely not. So we know that the information's wrong, but let's not change the display. And meanwhile, thousands and thousands of people walk by pointing out to their children, that's what your ancestors used to look like. As far as Lucy and the Australopithecines are concerned, we now know that there is no similarity in appearance to humans. They had long arms identical to a chimpanzee, jaw similar to a chimpanzee, upper leg bone similar to a chimpanzee. Lucy's legs were very ape-like. The brain size was overlapping that of a chimpanzee. Large back muscles for tree-dwelling, hands similar to a pink chimpanzee. Feet were long and curved. In other words, Lucy was an ape. And yet still is considered by many to be strong evidence for human evolution. Now, this is where it gets kind of fun. We could bring in evolutionists this morning, and I could recruit some diehard evolutionists and put them on two sides of this room, and we could just let them battle it out. With this group over here saying Lucy is obviously an ancestor of man, and this group over here saying Lucy is obviously not an ancestor of man. You can see it's not that clear. There's great disagreement among even evolutionary scientists on this. As far as the Smithsonian is concerned, they do have Australopithecus afarensis as part of their new display, and they display her like this. They have fixed some of the problems with the feet. They make them less human-like, but they still have the big toe in a straight line with the other toes, which is an error. But when they display it, they displayed it in such a way that you have a concrete floor here and they've embedded the Laetoli footprints or reproduction of the Laetoli footprints right next to this display, making it very clear that this creature supposedly made these human footprints. But the evidence really is not that strong. So again, how accurate are the casts and the pictures and things that we see in museums and in textbooks? Here's a photograph of an actual skull that's been considered along the line of evolution to humans. And here's how it appeared in a biology textbook. If you look, you'll see that there are some differences between the real thing and the illustration by the artist. Now, I am not an artist, but if I was going to try to draw this, I think I would have gotten some of these things right. Number one, the teeth. A huge difference in the tooth shape here. This looking obviously more human than this. The artist apparently didn't notice that those teeth were a little more pointy over there. The eye sockets are very different. And here's a big difference. A flatter face on the original one than we have actually on the drawing. In fact, they actually added in the drawing a nasal bone. You know, the human skull has a bone right here. You can feel it. And you have a ridge right here, and below that, your nose wiggles. That's cartilage. But this part up here is actual bone, structural. You should see what it looks like up here as everybody out there is going like this. And that allows us to wear glasses. And so somebody had asked me about my skull with glasses. This is here for a reason. You see, if you take a pair of glasses and you try to put them on a chimpanzee's skull, it just doesn't work. Or if we try to put them on Australopithecus afarensis, you can see it doesn't work either because Lucy also was lacking a nasal bone. One of the easiest ways to tell the difference between a human skull and an ape skull is look for that nasal bone. Lucy was not a human. Neanderthal once was presented as one of the major arguments for evolution. Now, that has changed quite a bit. But when originally presented, this is how Neanderthal was presented. Stooped over, brutish, ape-like, grunts, you know, grabs the female by the hair, drags her into the cave, that type of thing, right? In fact, we still hear people talk about that today if they're referring to a guy who's very uncultured, or Bruce, they'll say, he's such a Neanderthal. And yet, what are they saying? First found in Germany back in the 1800s, constructed to look ape-like, although the brain capacity actually a little bit larger than that of modern man by about 200 cubic centimeters. The initial construction, however, appears to have been wrong. This is how we now picture Neanderthal man, because now we know that Neanderthal man made jewelry, used musical instruments, did cave painting, set broken bones, was capable of speech, they buried their dead, and they may have performed surgeries and used cosmetics. Not exactly the idea that you get from an ape evolving into man. Our view of Neanderthal has changed greatly. Lubinov, in his book, one of his books, he's an anthropologist, a creationist, who has studied Neanderthals and other human skeletal remains to a great extent, has said that most anthropologists recognize burial as a very human, very religious act. But the strongest evidence that Neanderthals were fully human and of our species is that at four sites, Neanderthals and modern humans are buried together. Interestingly, it's still presented, however, in very interesting ways. This is a diagram on display at a museum counter in Berlin. What's interesting, if you know anything about skulls, is you'll see that the jaw is over an inch out of socket, causing that jaw to jut forward, making it look much more ape-like. If you put that jaw where it belongs, the skull takes on a very different look, looking much more human. But what about those brow ridges? And that's one of the things that people comment on, is these amazing brow ridges on Neanderthal. Well, they did have these brow ridges. They had a shorter, stocky body, shortest extremities. But the brow ridges, we now know through modeling that you can actually develop those brow ridges. Ladies, if you like that appearance, all right, just serve your guy a lot of really tough meat. And the way that the muscles have to work, the compressing of the bones, you can actually develop thick brow ridges. Okay. Now, let's be real. We probably are thinking right now, I know a guy with brow ridges. Is that what you're thinking back there? I know a guy. Like, I have seen people. I go to the mall sometimes in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. I have seen people walk by with heavy brow ridges. I'll let you in on a little secret. I really would love to publish a book, which is just a photographic essay of people's heads, where I just have side pictures of their skulls with a, you know, little diagram next to it showing the shape of the skull. But I don't know how to go about doing a book like that. How do you walk up to a 300-pound bruiser at the mall and say, hey, you've got great brow ridges. Can I take your picture? I'm not going there, right? But the point is, look when you're out in public. Look around. You will see amazing variety in the shape of people's skulls. We've also found Neanderthal DNA, and we've tested that and found that there's no significant difference between Neanderthal DNA and human, modern human DNA. Neanderthal was human. And they are now presented that way often in museums. And here's a display now that's more accurate in its presentation of Neanderthal. People that lived in a harsh, cold climate and developed certain features within their group. This skull here is a fossil find known as Piltdown Man. Now, Piltdown Man, the students today would probably not hear much about, but I know of people that were taught about Piltdown Man in class. Piltdown Man actually was found in the early 1900s and was said to be an incredible find because it had a what appeared to be a human skull or part of a human skull and a very ape-like jaw, but the teeth looked somewhat human. It was said to be about 500,000 years old and so had features of both human and ape, and so obviously the perfect missing link. In fact, when it was discovered, the New York Times ran a headline declaring Darwin theory is proved true. And this became a major item in textbooks and encyclopedias and museum displays, and was not actually examined by scientists for almost 40-some years. And then when they did discover it, or when they analyzed the actual find, they found out that it really was a fraud. The bones were only about 600 years old. They had been stained with chemicals to make them look older. The teeth had been filed down to make them look more human-like. It was an outright hoax in order to fool people into thinking that it was a great evidence for evolution. Now, I'm not saying that evolutionists are all like that. They're not. But there's a lot of money to be made if you come up with the latest and greatest discovery that indicates somehow how man has evolved. I sometimes tell my students, follow the money and see who's funding what. Because as soon as somebody discovers something new, National Geographic is there with their checkbook in hand. NOVA or PBS, they show up and they're ready to fund several more years of research. Follow the money. We'll explain some of the discoveries that we find. Nebraska Man is also one that some of you may have heard of if you're familiar with history. Nebraska Man was based on a single tooth. That tooth was said, it was found in 1922, was said to be both human-like and ape-like at the same time, and therefore is good evidence. And from that one single tooth, they actually drew pictures of what he looked like and talked about what he ate and all that kind of other stuff. Was actually used as a major piece of evidence at the 1925 Scopes trial, which changed American education forever. What's interesting is even though it was claimed to be 1,000,000 years old, we now know that it's simply the tooth of an extinct pig. But sadly, the damage had already been done at the trial as this was presented, and the interpretation was presented that this was good evidence for the evolution of man. So what do we do if we've got these kind of strange things that we talked about? What do we do with legitimate fossil remains of humans? You know, many times you'll read that the evidence for human past is very sketchy within the fossils. But in reality, we have thousands of human fossils. The problem is, for the evolutionist, is that the fossils look just like us. There's only a few noteworthy cases where they look different, and those are the ones where all the attention, of course, is focused on. Keep in mind that within humans, there's tremendous variation within people groups. Some people groups have very small stature. Other people groups, like basketball players, have very large stature. I'm old enough to remember an actor named Billy Barty, who lived in Hollywood years ago. He's a famous actor. He stood only 3'9" tall. And, of course, most of you have heard of Shaq O'Neal, who stands over 7 feet tall. Billy Barty, if you could clone him, would have been able to stand on his own shoulders and been about the same height as Shaq. 2 for 1. Now, that doesn't mean that he was less human. It simply shows the variation that's possible within the human species. This is genetic variation. Disease also can change bone structure as well. Something known as Paget's disease or Crouzon syndrome can reshape bones. The way we eat can also have an effect. If we're malnourished, rickets, for instance, can cause bones to deform. And this fascinates me, that we will find very almost complete skeletons that look just like us. You don't hear much about them, but then somebody finds an individual bone fragment somewhere else, and a big deal is made out of it because of how it looks a little bit different. How do we know it wasn't affected by some type of disease? Or just even within the variation or malnutrition? So if we take all of the hominid fossils that are out there, what we see is that there is a history of mistakes and sometimes outright fraud. Neanderthals are 100% human. Lucy and Australopithecines are just extinct chimpanzee-like creatures. A lot of misinformation out there in textbooks. And there are attempts to censor any efforts to bring some of the things that I'm telling you this morning to the public. Most students who go to public school will never hear what you're hearing this morning, because they're only allowed to be taught one thing, and that is that the idea that man has evolved. Scopes has gone in absolute reverse. It used to be illegal to teach the evolution of man. Now it has become to the point where you're not allowed to teach anything but the evolution of man. I like what Cervantes says. Many schools proclaim as a matter without any doubt that man is derived from the African apes. But this is a falsehood which any honest scientist should protest against. It is not balanced teaching. That which science has never demonstrated should be erased from any textbooks and from our minds and remembered only as a joke in bad taste. Or if only that were true. But one of the latest things, I want to finish up by talking about this real quick. One of the things that students are being taught today is about the similarities in the DNA between humans and chimps. And I see a number of students here. How many of you have heard about this? Human and chimp DNA. It looks like most of them have heard about this. All right. We're told that if you look at the DNA of humans and if you look at the DNA of a chimpanzee, that we are about 99% the same. And therefore, that is strong evidence, we are told, that we evolved from a similar ancestor as the chimpanzee. Well, let's talk a little bit about DNA. My students always laugh at me because I love DNA. Oh, I just love DNA because it is such an amazing structure. It is a molecule. It is an information-carrying molecule. This is a model of DNA or a small segment of DNA magnified 40 million times. If you took a single strand of DNA out of one of your cells and you were to enlarge it 40 million times to this scale, it would actually be miles long. Well, in reality, it would be 1,264 miles long. That's an incredibly large molecule. And all along the way, you've got information contained in these chemicals that work just like letters in the alphabet. It is a ladder structure that's kind of twisted. We call it a double helix. And it has these four chemicals or four letters to the language of DNA. You know, the whole concept of information is important. I talked about this the last time that I was here, that if you went into your kitchen and you found something that looked like that, you would say somebody was playing a game and didn't bother cleaning up. But if you look closely, you might notice that some of the letters actually are arranged here in a simple pattern, and you would think to yourself, oh, somebody had started to do something with the letters. Now, it is possible, although not probable, that that could occur just by dumping letters out. Right, you could end up with ABC on your table with, you can imagine that possibly happening. But if you walked into your kitchen and you saw something that looked like that, you would know that that was not from random dumping of letters. Some intelligence wasn't, well, depending on your perspective, maybe not much intelligence, so we'll make it less controversial. You see something like this, and that's my wife, Loretta, you know that there was some intelligence involved in that. All right, a lot of intelligence, the fact that he presents this in public then, too. But the point being that, you know, no one is going to believe that this happened by random chance. And yet the amount of information contained in that simple statement compared to the information contained in a single DNA molecule, there's no comparison. DNA is responsible for not only everything that you look like, but all of your bodily functions, everything that takes place, all the proteins that are being produced, all of the chemicals that are being used within the body. The DNA has the plans, the recipe, if you will, for how all of that takes place, all based on a language made with four letters. And these four letters in a certain arrangement within the DNA give us all of this information. And so here's the deal. We are told that if we look at our DNA and we look at a chimp DNA, that they are 99% the same. But is that true when we actually do the comparison? You know, there are some major differences. One thing that's different is chimps have 24 pair of chromosomes. Humans have only 23 pair of chromosomes. So the evolutionist says, well, at some time in our evolutionary past, a couple of the chromosomes actually merged together and became our 23 pair. The very end of a chromosome, you've got what's known as the telomere. A chimp has telomeres that are 23,000 bases long. The bases are these rungs of the ladder. And so you've got these telomeres 23,000 rungs long as opposed to humans, which is only 10 kilobases long or 10,000 rungs long. So that's a huge difference. If you look at the Y chromosome between a human and chimpanzee, there's no comparison. They're hugely different from one another. But what I find most interesting, and maybe those of you that are really into mathematics can explain this to me. How is it possible that a chimpanzee contains approximately 111% in the amount of genetic information as humans? They have about 11% more genetic information than humans do. And yet we're 99% the same. How does that work out mathematically? Well, it doesn't. What we have to understand is that this 99% is not looking at the entire chimp genome and the entire human genome, and there's a 99% comparison. There's actually three problems with comparing human to chimp DNA. One is sequencing is very difficult. Until just very recently, you had to do all of your sequencing by taking little segments known as trace reads, only going to be 75 to 1,200 bases long, again, rungs of the ladder. And so you're getting these little segments of DNA, and then you have to kind of try to line them up to get the full length or the full genome. You have to assemble them correctly. A geneticist explained it this way. He says, imagine going out buying 10,000 boxes of an identical puzzle, opening all of those boxes and dumping all of the pieces on the floor and mixing them up. Now you go into this huge pile of puzzle pieces, and you're pulling them out, attempting to put together the original puzzle. He says that's what it's like to sequence DNA. Now, human researchers are looking at the human DNA had a little bit of help in that we already had some basic understanding of parts of our genome. And we, you know, just from other things, we already had something to go on. So in a sense, we kind of almost had a picture on the box. And you know that if you have a picture on the box, putting a puzzle together is a lot easier, correct? And so they kind of had a picture, and we eventually developed the human genome. We were able to say, this is the human genome. But when it came to discovering the chimpanzee genome, it was very different because we didn't have all of those extra resources. And so the idea was basically this. Hey, humans and apes obviously evolved from a common ancestor. Therefore, our DNA must be similar. Let's use the human picture on the box and use that as a template or a framework upon which to hang the chimpanzee DNA. So when they tried to develop the chimp DNA, they actually used the human DNA as a scaffolding. Well, that's obviously going to lead to great alignment, even if the genomes are vastly different. Remember, you're only dealing with little segments. The second problem with this comparison is that the entire genome is not used. When you hear that there's a 99% comparison between the two, you have to understand that that's comparing only about 4% of the genome. 99% of the 4% are the same. And that 4% itself was data masked and filtered and basically picked. It has to do with junk DNA, the idea that humans are carrying around within them DNA that's just kind of evolutionary leftover. And so they would accept substitutions as a difference, but what are known as indels, insertions or deletions, those would not be considered as a difference. I can see some of you aren't quite tracking, so let me explain it this way. Let's say we're going to compare a couple sentences. Here's a sentence. Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers. All right? And you now compare that to the sentence, Peter Piper packed a peck of pickled peppers. Now, you'll notice that there's only one change here. A single letter has been switched. That would be called a substitution. And so according to these researchers, they would say that is a difference. We will count that as a difference between the two sentences. But if I were to give you this sentence, Peter Piper picked a peck of nice pickled peppers, that's now considered an insertion, and so that's not considered as a difference between the two sentences. In the same way, if we were to say Peter Piper picked a peck of peppers, we've now removed a word, that's a deletion, and therefore that's also not considered as a difference. You see, you can selectively compare the way you want to get numbers to work out the way you want. In other words, the data was cherry-picked to give the closest alignment possible. Again, this idea of junk DNA, I kind of have to just skip through this. We used to think a lot of DNA served no purpose, but now we know that most of our DNA does have functioning. The ENCODE project shows that at least 80% of our DNA actually codes for proteins. And they believe, some of them, that actually will go to 100%. I would not be surprised. My Bible says that I am fearfully and wonderfully made, and God designed me. I believe everything in our DNA had an original purpose. If we find something that doesn't have purpose, it's because we have lost that purpose as we continue to decay at following sin. But this idea of 99%, if we eliminate this insertion deletion part, you know, and actually include those in, that 99% drops to 95%. Now, it still sounds awfully similar, but remember, 5% can be a big difference depending what you're talking about. I'm a school teacher at a private Christian school in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. If I gave you 5% of my annual income, your lifestyle will not change. I'm not complaining, I'm just stating a fact. But if Bill Gates would give you 5% of his annual income, time to buy a new car dealership, right? Because, you know, that's a huge amount. When we're talking 5% of the human genome, we are talking about over 150 million base pairs, 150 million rungs on the ladder difference. That is a huge difference. Keep in mind that we share about half of our DNA with a banana. Your DNA, this is where husbands sometimes look at their wives and say, I told you I had appeal. But anyway, the point is, that was for you, Tom. The point is that there is great similarities in DNA of many living things. You know, one third and final point that makes it difficult comparing these DNA is that there's a lot of contamination within the DNA. It's well documented that in the chimp DNA genome that there is human contamination. All it takes is for a single human skin cell to get into the chimp sample, and you've skewed the DNA. And this is especially pronounced in the earlier samplings of chimp DNA. But here's where Dr. Jeffrey Tompkins comes into play. He's a geneticist working at the Institute for Creation Research. He had a novel idea. He says, hey, why don't we take the whole chimp genome and we'll take the whole human genome and actually compare them together? Nobody has thought to do that before. And so he actually has done over 1.2 million alignments using 40,000 segments of chimp and human DNA, and he's putting them together in the best and most optimal alignment possible, and finds that if you actually do that, that the comparison with DNA between chimp and humans actually comes out closer to 85%. 85%. That's a huge difference. That's over 450 million base pairs difference within the two genomes. And keep in mind, we shouldn't be surprised if there are some similarities. Others are now starting to join in on this, including Dr. Prius, who is not a creationist, but he says, too, that you know this idea of 98%, 99%, that's just not true. And yet, if you go to the Smithsonian, they're still telling us that we are 98.8% genetically similar to a chimpanzee. Now, they tell us that we're 60% similar to a banana, 85% similar to a mouse. Okay, remember when I was here one time before, I talked about what's called homology. You compare the bones in the arm of a human, you compare the bones in the front legs of many animals, you have the same three bones. And so people say, oh, look, evidence for evolution. No. Fact, yes, same three bones. Interpretation, common ancestor, or common designer. That's what this is as well, just on the molecular level. It all depends on your interpretation. Are the similarities in the DNA because of similar ancestor or because of similar design? We live in the same world as a chimpanzee. I ate a banana this week. I have to metabolize that banana the same way a chimpanzee metabolizes that banana. And so I'm going to have some of the same biochemical processes that the chimp will have. We should expect to have similarities. I breathe the same air as a chimpanzee. I use that oxygen in a similar way. Cellular respiration works the same, right? And so all of these things, we should expect to find similarities. We were designed to live in the same world. This is not evidence for evolution, even though it's presented that way in museums. Sadly, again, often promoting it to children that they are nothing more than highly evolved apes. I like what Dr. Richard Swenson says. He says, as a scientist with training in both medicine and physics, it's easily apparent to me that the majesty of God is revealed in the human body. Or as the psalmist put it, I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. Returning quickly back to how we started, looking at these monuments, we bought into the idea of man getting better, and therefore we're surprised at these ancient technologies. And I present this to my students and say, hey, we were created highly intelligent, and we're not evolving, we're actually de-evolving. We are degenerating. We are genetically inferior to those who have come before us. Dr. John Sanford, Cornell University, actually presents the idea that we are losing 1% to 2% of our genetic integrity every generation. This is not a popular message, especially for young people. You are genetically inferior to your parents. But I tell my students, don't let that bug you. Your parents are genetically inferior to your grandparents. And so on and so forth all the way back. That should be expected. We sinned against a holy God. Sin brought a curse upon this world. Things are in decay. Scripture says that the world or the universe is wearing out like an old cloth. This is to be expected. But my students will ask me then, they'll say, then how come we have so much stuff? And they'll hold up a cell phone. Well, they're not allowed to have cell phones in class, but yeah, they'll talk about their cell phones. And I would hold mine up, except it's charging right now in Pastor Tom's office. And I hold it up and I say, how is it that we walk around in our pockets with more computer power than what actually guided the Apollo rocket to the moon? And my students are saying, what do you mean we're degenerating? And I have to use an illustration that I heard from Dr. John Whitcomb many years ago. He says it's kind of like circus performers. You see circus performers all stacked up like this, an amazing human pyramid. And you listen carefully, and you hear the little guy at the top, and it's always a little guy at the top. You don't put your big bruiser up at the top. He's down on the bottom. You put the little guy up top, and then you listen carefully, and you can hear him yelling, I am the greatest. I am the greatest. He is the greatest in accumulated height. But intrinsically, he is the weakest of them all. That's us at the top of the pyramid. We are the greatest in accumulated knowledge over the centuries, standing on the shoulders of those who came before us. But intrinsically, we are weaker than anyone who has come before as a population. And we continue to degenerate. You doubt that? Talk to somebody who has taught school for 30 years and ask them the difference that they see between the intellectual abilities of students today and those 30 years ago. Young people, this is not an insult, but it is a clear, demonstrative way of helping us understand that we are in decline because we have sinned against the holy God. Bible says to us, see to it that no one takes you captive through hollow and deceptive philosophy. Pause. This is the Apostle Paul writing to the church at Colossae. They were Christians. And he's saying to Christians, make sure you are not taken captive. That implies that Christians can be taken captive through hollow and deceptive philosophy. Make sure you are not taken captive by hollow and deceptive philosophy, which depends on human tradition, the basic principles of this world, rather than on Christ. Folks, evolution is not science. It is an interpretation of some of the things that we find in the world today, and it is a wrong interpretation, skewed beyond imagination because people trying to continue to rebel against a holy God. As I tell my students, you have a choice to make. You can believe the words of people who were not there at the beginning, people who do not know everything, people who make mistakes, and people who will sometimes even lie. Or you can believe the word of the one who does know everything, the one who was there at the beginning, the one who makes no mistakes, and the one who does not lie. For me, this is where I'm basing my faith. This is where I'm basing my thoughts. This is the truth, and we can stand on that. I leave you with these websites. Parents, I would encourage you to jot these down, especially if your kids are in public school. These are great websites where you can go and you can find tons of articles and resources on various things having to do with creation and evolution. And everything that I presented this morning really comes from these websites, well, the majority of it. And so I challenge you, don't allow yourself or your kids be swayed by the ideas of man today. Let me pray for you, and then I'll let Tom close. Father, thank you that your word is true. Thank you that you have told us not only about the history of the world, but you've told us about our history, and you've told us about yourself. And so, Lord, I thank you for this group of people who stand here and proclaim that your word is true. And I pray that you would encourage them and that you would bless them and that you would strengthen their faith even more than ever to stand firm to what your word says. Thank you, Lord, for your graciousness to us. In Jesus' name, amen.